You are now listening to The Griot's Black Podcast Network, Black Culture Amplified.
So we're here today with Dr. Christina Greer, a previous guest on the podcast, and I've been a guest on her podcast. But, you know, we're always lucky and thankful to have a guest who knows things on The Griot Daily. Welcome to The Griot Daily, Dr. Christina Greer.
I'm always so happy to talk to you, Michael.
Right. I just want to make sure I am not going to have to answer any questions today, right? Because, like, I didn't bring my trivia brain with me when we started recording. So I just want to make sure that, like, I'm not going to fail the pop quiz or anything.
No, you're off the hook. No pop quizzes. The semester hasn't started yet.
I know you have a book coming out. And, you know, of course, you always drop science whenever you write or talk or teach. So tell me what your upcoming book is about.
So I have a book that I'm finishing on Fannie Lou Hamer, Barbara Jordan, and Stacey Abrams. And essentially that argument is if Fannie Lou Hamer and Barbara Jordan had a baby 50 years later, it would be Stacey Abrams. The book that I wrote that we're going to sort of talk about today, you know, as the Griot celebrates Africa and our diasporic consciousness, is my book, Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream, where I investigate sort of some shared attitudes of Black, Caribbean, and African respondents, but also some areas of difference and distinction to answer the larger question, what are some of the substantive policy issues where we fundamentally agree? And then what are some other issues where we might not be on the same page so we can actually figure out how we can get on the same page so we can get more collectively as a larger group?
Right. So let's start at the beginning. And, you know, there are people, Americans in the Caribbean, who consider themselves, as I do, or a lot of people do, as African. Some say that they're Black, and some make a distinction between Black American and African and, for instance, Jamaican or Bajan. So I want you to kind of explain what are those similarities and the differences between those things.
Right, Michael. And, you know, I always tell people identity is personal. So how you identify, it might not always line up with how, you know, even someone in your own family identifies. It also depends on where you grew up. So in my book, I call descendants of U.S. chattel slavery Black Americans, because it's easier for me to distinguish Black Americans from, say, African immigrants. So I don't have to say African-Americans and African-Americans. So I have Black Americans, I have Caribbean Americans, and I have African Americans. And African Americans are those who have migrated from the continent of Africa. In the first one, two, maybe even three generations, Caribbeans have migrated from the Caribbean, and then Black Americans who are descendants of U.S. chattel slavery. Obviously, it's not, you know, cut and dry. There are lots of people who, you know, have a grandparent from the Caribbean and another grandparent from Georgia, you know, so it's like, it really does depend on how you self-identify. In writing this book, I found out that my grandmother was Bahamian, but because she passed away before I was born, and we didn't really talk about ethnicity in my family, I always called myself a JB, which is just Black. And so that's descendant of U.S. chattel slavery, because in college where people, you know, would often ask, oh, where are you from? And it's like, oh, you know, I'm from Philly, you know, I'm from Atlanta, wherever it is. It's like, you know, then the follow-up question is like, no, where are you from? That from question. And I was like, Florida? You know, it's like, no, where are your people from? And it's like, Yulee? Like, you know, this tiny town that my grandparents lived in. And so this idea that, like, we're not from, quote unquote, anywhere specific, I just started, you know, we called ourselves the JBs. It's like, no, I'm just Black. Like, that's it. But recognizing that that identity is really powerful as well. I mean, being a JB, just Black, means that, you know, your ancestors helped build the foundation of this nation, literally planting the seeds in the soil for this country. So it's not as easy to define oneself. You know, if you grow up in a city where, let's just say your parents are immigrants from, say, Nigeria, if you grow up in DC and you're surrounded by other Nigerians, you might keep that identity as Nigerian American. But if you grow up, let's just say, and your parents were the only Nigerians in a town, you know, in Nebraska, and it's a lot of, you know, Black Americans, not a lot, but, you know, there are more Black Americans as Black people, then you might, as second generation, identify as Black, not necessarily ethnically, but more of a shared racial identity. And so I was just really trying to detangle some of that, because when I was an undergrad, it was such a small group of us at a predominantly white institution. I call it a HWCU. So, you know, because it's a university set up for the production of white knowledge. So it was a small group of Black folks, but we sort of, not only were we all part of this one shared BSA, we called it the Pan-African Alliance at that point in time, but, you know, as most universities know it as like the Black Student Alliance. So we were all under this umbrella together. But during my tenure as an undergrad, the Caribbeans broke off and formed their own group, the Caribbean Student Association. The African students broke off and formed the African Students Association. But then they still had a shared membership with the Black Student Association. So it was a both and duality of recognizing your ethnicity, but also a shared racial identity.
Right. And that's an important thing, how, first of all, personal that identity is. And the other thing is how, you know, the shared commonalities is how really the world reacts to Blackness. And, you know, as someone, I remember as someone from the Geechee, you know, the Geechee Gullah culture, I remember, you know, when people started saying, you know, there are descendants of enslaved people, which is not necessarily a recent thing. And my grandmother said, well, you know, you don't resist, you don't reduce the totality of your ancestors to something white people did to us. And I always remembered that. Like, you know, your history starts way before white people showed up in Africa, and reducing it to that, you know, it's kind of a disservice to some people, to their ancestors. But I want you to talk about some of the shared commonalities that these, what you call just Black people, Black Americans, Black people from the Caribbean, and, you know, from the diaspora, right? Because it can't even be reduced to those people. We have talk about people, Black people from South America, Brazilians. We have Black people from, you know, Canada, the Black Nova Scotians. So it's a worldwide diaspora of Black people. And talk about some of the shared commonalities that we all have.
I mean, Michael, you just said it. I mean, we're everywhere. And, you know, it really does hit home just how large and expansive the chattel slavery trade was across the globe. I mean, the fact that we do have, you know, distant diasporic cousins all across South America and, you know, the Caribbean, throughout the Caribbean. But, you know, the shared identity is so powerful to me because, you know, I have some vignettes in the book, and even when we're at university and people who have gone to white schools know that, you know, oftentimes we're kind of lumped together. So, you know, at university, when we were having parties where there was no alcohol being served, it's like our parties were broken up, but not white parties. And so we were together in this shared discrimination. And during the time that I was in, you know, writing this book and in undergrad, you know, we had Rodney King and Abner Louima and Amadou Diallo. Those were sort of the three big sort of police brutality cases. And they, in many ways, they represented Black American, Caribbean, and African immigrants being brutalized by the police. And it's, you know, the police didn't necessarily stop and ask, are you Black American? Are you, you know, from Guinea? Like, are you Haitian? Or are you, you know, Jamaican? Those distinctions don't matter when you're being abused by anyone. But I think the reason why I was interested in trying to dissect some of these questions and really figure out where we have these shared policy positions is because of residential segregation and the fact that Black immigrants are oftentimes placed in Black communities or move into Black communities for a host of reasons, some racialized, some racist reasons why they settle with Black communities. And that's where we see some of these tensions. We do see communities coming together, but there are a lot of Black immigrants who are just like, well, wait a minute, if I'm coming over here the same day as someone from Asia or Europe, why is it that I get this Black prefix? I can't just be American like everybody else. It's like, no, you're lumped in with Black Americans. And that also means you're going to the same schools, you're going living in the same neighborhoods, you're having a similar circumstance, depending on, you know, the country and the context in which you migrate. But we know that race and racism travel, and we know that, you know, there are real inequities that Black Americans still face. So when Black immigrants are in Black American neighborhoods, like, well, why am I getting subpar schools? Why am I getting subpar housing? Why am I getting, you know, environmental racism? All these things that Black Americans are far too used to and well-versed in dissecting. So that's where some of the tension can come in, because we're battling over this perception of scarce resources. And I always say perception of scarce resources, because this is America. There's no such thing as scarce resources. You saw that we just found $150 billion under the couch cushions in 20 minutes for a foreign nation. So we got the money. It's just how we allocate the money. And so this idea that Black immigrants can't just become American without a mandatory Black prefix was something that I was really interested in really interrogating and seeing how Black immigrants felt about this idea that they're kind of lumped in with people in a dichotomous relationship where Black Americans in many ways are on the bottom in the imagination of a lot of white policy and white people, and a country that's been founded on this idea of white supremacy and anti-Black racism. You know, and those are not the same thing. And everyone is always asking, it's like, well, white supremacy is the same thing as anti-Black racism. I'm like, no. In this nation, it's a very specific anti-Black racism where we can literally look at every single policy that has ever been created, and it has a foundation in racism specifically targeted against Black people. Other folks and other groups get caught up in the net, but it's against Black people. So it's not just about being a white supremacist or having a nation that believes in white supremacy. It's also both and having a nation that is predicated on subjugating Black people. And Black immigrants kind of get caught up in that crossfire.
Join us next time on The Griot Daily for Episode 2, Conflicts Throughout the Diaspora.
If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review, download the Griot app, subscribe to the show, and share it with everyone you know. Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to podcasts@thegriot.com.
You are now listening to The Griot's Black Podcast Network.